looking back at the decisions I made ethically through my eyes and the eyes of people I love is the only way to live any sort of life of any sort of integrity for me.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Over the past few years, Tisha Filyaw and Kiese Lehman have worked their way into the top tier of American writers. Filyaw's short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, was a finalist for the National Book Award and is being adapted into a TV series for HBO. Lehman's book, Heavy, was named one of the 50 best memoirs of the last 50 years by the New York Times, and he's a recipient of one of those MacArthur Genius Grants. They're also longtime friends, and now they're teaming up for a new podcast called Reckon True Stories, which debuts July 9th. They'll be talking to each other and interviewing other writers, such as Roxane Gay and Alexander Chi, about all types of nonfiction writing. The three of us talked about everything from how success and money has affected their work to their first memories of how words change their lives. Speaking of words, Tisha and Kiese do not hold back. There are some four-letter words, eight-letter words, and even a couple of 12-letter words in this talk. So if that kind of language bothers you, just know that going in. But I promise, if you want to understand the creative process and the mind of an artist, this is well worth your time. Here's our conversation. I think essays for a lot of people sort of come with like a trigger warning, you know, because we're taught this stuff in school and had to, you know, do these essays and do them in a certain format. And y'all talk about those things. Is part of what y'all doing trying to kind of like reclaim the essay as something that's worthy for maybe even non-writers to think about and read?
I feel like we're definitely celebrating the essay. And I think because we do take for granted and are, you know, have some awareness of all that essays are and all that they can do, that your question is a good reminder that part of our audience will be people for whom that's not a given. Right. You know, I was talking to a friend recently about some writing she wants to do. And she was like, you know, it's based on her family and her family history. So I'm like, okay, so yeah, memoir. And she's like, no, but it's kind of like a novel though. And so we like going back and forth and I'm like, oh, you're talking about creative nonfiction. She's like, what's that? Right? You know? And so, yes. So I think, you know, our audience is, there's going to be what we're offering, I think will appeal to a wide range of folks who are, you know, writers, veteran writers who know what creative nonfiction is and, you know, want to celebrate it with us. And then other folks who will get more of an education about the form and all of the different ways it shows up and how nimble essays are and how what we taught were taught in school, for the most part, hinders us now as creative people, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction.
And when we were coming into this, I also say, Tommy, that like, I really am thankful for Tisha for pushing me because, you know, honestly, bowing down to the essay the way I think school and different people in my life demanded I bow down, you know, would have necessitated that I never make it to this podcast talking to y'all. You know what I'm saying? My entire life has been really, whether I knew it consciously or unconsciously, about taking what they told me the essay was, doing my own, you know, sort of investigation, research into what it could be, and then just adding some shit I never seen to it. You know what I'm saying? So like, I'm here literally because I did not believe what they told me the essay was capable of doing. Like, I thought once you could put that eye in that essay, I thought you could do a lot more than what they told us to do. And really, this podcast is an exploration of, like, that relationship with the eye and the relationship with the form that a lot of us have, though we're from all different places on the map. You know, a lot of us were just beat over the head with that five-paragraph essay and made to submit. And a lot of us kind of were like, nah, I'm not going to submit, you know?
Yeah, you talk about that in that first episode, how, first of all, you know, you were taught, as all of us were taught, not to write about yourself. And then also you felt like, not only that, you couldn't like depict the truth of like your family, like, because all the people in all the sample essays, all the grandmas were white,
right,
and that sort of thing. And is that, you know, when did you kind of feel like you could break out of there? What do you remember, like a breakthrough where you're like, oh, it doesn't have to be this way?
I mean, I remember reading, like, you know, why, you know, Welty and, you know, Life at the PO and a lot of Flannery O'Connor, and just kind of like a lot of people falling in love with those grannies. But I had a black granny who had, like, you know, similar attitude and a texture and shit. And I was like, why do I never see them? You know, and somebody would bring up Phoenix, you know, from the Welty story. And I'd be like, yeah, Phoenix is like a look at what a black grandmother could be, but like, do we get her interiority and do we get her storytelling? Because I come from a space where like black grandmothers, yes, have to do a lot of labor, but one of the, you know, kind of like glorious, laborious things they do is tell these stories. And these stories sometimes embody that eye, you know, and that eye is wild and hyperbolic and just incredible. And so I don't know how you can be talking to kids about people about storytelling in the Deep South, and then like this particular, like, you know, group of people who can't even be grandmothers, you know what I'm saying? Like, when grandmothers are so central to our being, particularly in the Deep South, you know what I mean? So that I remember that early being like, damn, I don't see nobody like my grandmama in any of the shit they're telling us to read, which is one of the reasons I write about my grandmother all the time.
Yeah. And do you feel like, you mentioned grandmothers in the Deep South, do you feel like, you know, y'all have been lived and worked in lots of other places now, do you feel like that, you know, Southerners always think, you know, we have the best storytellers? Have you found that to be true?
We do. Oh, absolutely. We do. Shit, I mean, we've lived other places, but I mean, I don't know about Kiese, but I don't write about the other places I've lived. Like, I still write about, you know, write and position my people in the South. And, you know, even when I wrote a short story that was about people who had come to the place I was living at the time, which was Pittsburgh, it was about them longing for being in Jacksonville, being, you know, in Georgia. But absolutely, for me, you know, when I think about, you know, the seminal essays, you know, I think about Kiese's essays that became the collection, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, when those were first being published online. And I saw him doing something that I had never seen anyone do with essays before, and be very Southern. You know, so I don't have an MFA, so I didn't study a lot of the classics beyond what I had to study in college, you know, so I didn't have to overcome this idea that, you know, certain people were supposed to be, you know, the gold standard. I kind of rejected that in high school because I just found a lot of it boring. And even the white Southern literature, as Kiese said, that was not my Southern experience. And then when I think about another essay that was sort of seminal for me around what essays could do, it wasn't Southern, but it was another theme that's prominent for me, which is mothers and daughters. And it's Cheryl Strayed's Love of My Life, which was published in The Sun. And it was about grieving. So it's multiple things, mothers and daughters and grief, very unorthodox grief. She was speaking directly to me. I lost my mother in 2005. And I felt ashamed of some of the ways that I was grieving. It was all very secretive. Cheryl was writing about how when she was grieving her mother, she just was out cheating on her husband. She was just sleeping with, like, you know, all of these men. And then she would come home to her husband crying and broken. And I had never seen anyone do that on the page.
Yeah.
And that told me, like, oh, this is what an essay can do.
Deecha, in that episode I listened to, you talked about having written this like 20-page essay on your father, and how, you know, you sent it to a couple of, I guess, mentors or colleagues, basically saying, you know, where do I get this published? And they both sent back to you and said, nowhere.
Right.
You know, this is because it's too much. And so I guess,
right?
How do y'all navigate, like, you know, when I teach classes and stuff, there are people who come into the class and they want to write, basically, when it gets down to it, to like settle scores.
Yes.
And
yes.
And sometimes the scores need to be settled, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how do y'all navigate when to actually go through with it, when to pull back, and when maybe just not to do it at all?
So, you know, and I'm really interested in Kiese's thoughts on this. I think that part of the process of growing as an artist is that, or at least it has been for me, and I shouldn't be prescriptive for other people, but you know, if somebody were to ask my advice, I just think as an artist, there's so many more interesting things we can do than settling a score. When I was writing to settle a score or to, you know, have some sort of reckoning for my father, that first 20-page essay was like, it read like a deposition. It read like a, you know, a litany of his crimes against me. And when I became a better writer, as I grew as a writer, that was less important to me. And it allowed me to take all of the truth of what he did and make it something that was also artful. It wasn't just emotional and painful and exposing him. You know, all of those things have merit. But I also wanted to make art. The difference between, you know, something for my journal and something that when I put it out into the world, it can be become whatever other people need it to be as well. And I think that for newer writers, they don't understand that if they simply write to settle the score, not many other people besides them and people around them are going to care about that story. And so, for me, part of growing as a writer is writing such that it is deeply personal and impactful to you. It satisfied that need to, you know, tell what happened, you know, your version, and get some sense of justice to be heard. And when it's out in the world, it can mean something to other people. I think the mistake is that we assume that because something means something to us, it's going to mean something to other people. I would, you know, for students like that, I'm like, okay, that's a journal entry. Like somebody told me 20 years plus years ago, now let's turn it into art and not some lofty, you know, gatekeeping kind of art, but simply meaning something that other people can have access points to.
And sometimes you gotta know, like, I mean, Udisha, you are preaching 100% everything you said. And sometimes you gotta, you know, sometimes you gotta settle a score, and you're so driven by wrath and rage that you can channel that shit artistically, like on point, and it can go out there in the world, and the essay can impact a lot of people. But you might not have been ready for that because you wanted to settle a personal. And like, you know, I wrote an essay like that called "My Vassar College ID Makes Everything Okay." To this day, I think it's like the most read thing I've ever written, you know what I'm saying, on the internet. Like, millions of motherfuckers read that shit at Gawker. I was selling a score with the institution that I thought, you know, ultimately it broke my heart, you know, hired me when I was a youngster and blah, 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 blah. And I was telling the truth about myself because I'd broken my heart. But then I look back at that and I was like, man, I mean, it set the table for heavy, but I was giving people way too much, way too much entryway into like my actual life. And like, you know, one of the great things, I mean, there's nothing good about Gawker going under, but one of the good things for me in a way is that people can't find that essay anymore.
Man,
Because this shit is
I was
too,
about to start
man,
Googling too.
it's too much, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I was in my bag. Like, I was fucking around with the form. I was, you know, going in and out of like characters as we talk about Disha. I was like, you know, doing things that I really think artistically are good, but it was just too much. It was like I was opening myself way too much. First time I talked about my gambling addiction, it was just, you know, it just wasn't. It's first time I talked about my mother and my relationship to gambling. It wasn't. It got me to a good book, but I shouldn't have put that essay out.
Well, I want to ask about that, Kiese, especially with your mother. I know both of you have written about people living and dead. You know, so you co-wrote a book with your ex, you know, all that sort of thing. What has been y'all's experience when that comes out and the people who you wrote about see it, how they reacted to it?
Yes, say that's you.
I mean, again, you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back on anything, but I'm pretty fair when it comes to like bringing people who are characters into my shit. You know, that doesn't mean anybody's gonna love it, but I've never had my, you know, I haven't had anybody be like, "Why are you lying?" or why did you say that? You know, my mother has been often like, why'd you say that about yourself? Like, why'd you tell people this? Da da da. But you know, when I wrote that book, you know, my mama never was like, why'd you say that about us? Because you know, the conversation was at another level. You know, at that point, she definitely didn't want me to put some of that stuff in there about her that I was a party to. But other than that, you know, like I've had my friends again. Like I'm my friends are the kind of people who want to be in essays more. That's what I always like. We the 80s. We the motherfuckers in the 80s who, when you know, news crews came by, we up there trying to get on there, and be
in
like
the background, hey, like hey,
throwing up fake gang signs,
all up like, in the video. Like
all my people, all my friends want me to use their names in my shit. Like that, and people that I do that to, like consistently, is my boy Ray Gunn. Because yeah. Ray Gunn is sort of his nickname, but like it's his real name. Like everybody who knows us know is Ray Gunn because we call him Ray Gunn. But it's not his government name. So it's different. Yeah. So I haven't had anybody other than my ex girlfriend be like, "That's not what happened," and she was lying. Yeah, it didn't happen because I was under fucking writing it. Because what happened was like gross, sir. You know. But other than that, I haven't had many people be like, "That shit didn't happen that way."
And for me, you know, writing about my parents, and they're both dead, so I really wasn't writing about them until they died. My ex, our co-parenting book wasn't super personal, like the intro chapter sort of set the stage, and we wrote that together. But I did write about him in this essay for Gravy, a magazine of Southern Foodways, and it's something like On Gratitude and Blue Crabs. Mm. And it's about our relationship, and there's these moments. It's also about how to pick and eat blue crabs. You know, he came from Pittsburgh down to Jacksonville, said he knew how to eat crabs. He did not know how to eat crabs. I had crab. And then there's more to it, also about my relationship with my mother. And so, you know, I didn't feel like I needed to ask his permission to write about that, and about our relationship. You know, we're co-parenting, but our kids are in their 20s now. And so I just figured, you know, he's not going to know about it. I did share it with our daughters because I thought it gave a lens into who we were before they were born. And neither of them really cared too much about it. But I forgot when I posted it on Facebook that my mother-in-law and my father-in-law, his parents, who I still adore, they follow me on Facebook.
Oh boy.
And his mom reshared it on Facebook and was like, "My daughter-in-law, da da da," you know. And she texted me and was like, "This, I love this so much." And I was like, "Oh my God." Like, not that her son was terrible or bad or anything like that, but it wasn't glowing either. But so I think I will always think of Fran, her name is Fran, as kind of the blueprint for that. Someone who can put aside whatever personal things they may have and just honor what I'm trying to do. You know, I've been saying this mostly to women, mostly to mothers who are writing, who are asking, usually around, you know, how to make time to write. But I think this is true around writing nonfiction about other people than yourself. You have to be willing to disappoint people sometimes.
Mm.
And it's not, you know, because there are going to be people who are like, "I don't want you to write about that at all. I don't give a damn about a composite or, a, you know, whatever."
Right.
Don't write it. And it's like, but if it's your story to tell, you know, you can write it, and that person may be disappointed. Hopefully it doesn't end the relationship. Hopefully you can have a conversation about it.
What was it? Anne Lamott says if they didn't want you to write about them, they should have behaved better.
Exactly. And see, now that's an easier one because, you know, poorly behaved people can go kick rocks. But right. What if it's something that the person is simply ashamed of, you know, but you were part of that and you are also carrying that shame? You right. get to write about that, but they can certainly be upset with you. That's the thing. Like I used to tell my kids, like, you can't tell somebody how to feel about what you did. You know, they get to feel their right. feelings, you know. Yep. You were justified in all of that. They still get to feel their feelings. But I think a lot of us want people to you know, bless it. And it's okay if they don't bless it.
When we come back, Tisha Filial talks about how success has helped her have creative freedom.
I'm freer and with, you know, and I write with less of a burden now of worrying about, like, am I going to be able to pay my rent this month?
That and more, I head on southbound. But Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Deecha Filyaw and Kiese Lehman. Kiese, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the essay you wrote about Vassar. Both of you have been at, either attended or taught at, like elite universities where assuming at the time you were there or are there, there aren't many people who look like you. How do you talk to students at those places about navigating that world? And what do you wish you had known when you were students of those places?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, if I knew the shit I know, I wouldn't have been exploring, you know, like, I wouldn't have hit my head up against the wall. I wouldn't have gotten kicked out of college. I don't even know if I would have gone to college if I really knew what these mugs are really about from the inside. You know, I'm just saying from somebody on the inside. I do wish I had somebody around me. And this might get to conversation, might just spiral. But I wish I had somebody around me to be like, I don't have your back. Like, nobody here has your back. You know what I'm saying? When I was in college. Because that was the truth. And I was, you know, I came from like, you know, Black power parents and stuff. And I'm coming to college, and college for my parents is where like they form community. And like, I had friends, and you know, I went to Millsaps for my first school, and you know, I was there trying to play sports and stuff. But at the end of the day, man, like none of those professors or administrators who talked all of that shit were willing to stand up for right when it meant they could lose their jobs. And that's capitalism. But I just didn't even understand that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had to become a professor, get in trouble, have the administration like threaten to like kick me out for some shit I said or didn't say around the Israel-Palestine stuff when I was at Vassar, for me to realize, oh, okay, like right and wrong have nothing to do with this shit. Like nothing. And I didn't learn that till I was like 40. So I don't know. I don't know that I wish I would have known that as a kid, but I do think it's important for us to let like young people experiment in ways and protect them when they fall. And also, I got a cushy ass job and I get paid a grip. I don't want to be acting like, whoa, what's up? You know what I'm saying?
Well, okay. Well, actually, I'm glad you said that, because it leads right into the next thing I want to ask you. You know, both of y'all have obviously had some success at this gig. You know, you're making some money. You're not buying yachts, but you're making some money. And I wonder if or how that's affected your relationship with the work. Like, how has success changed the way you go to work every day?
Success? I was just talking with a friend. We were like, it's some bullshit when people say money can't buy happiness. It certainly helps. And it doesn't guarantee happiness.
You can definitely rent some happiness, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, short term. But, you know, I definitely feel like I'm freer and with, you know, and I write with less of a burden now of worrying about like, am I going to be able to pay my rent this month? Like, I feel freer creatively because I'm not doing 51 other things to make money, to buy a little bit of time to do my creative work. And so now my creative work is my work. And so not having to worry about taking care of myself or my family, that mental burden being off me frees me up in so many ways. You know, something that your question touches on is people will be like, well, there's all this pressure because when they give you a lot of money, there are all these expectations and you got to do this and what if and what if and what if and what if. And I realized that if I thought about any of that stuff, I would be so paralyzed, I'd never write.
Right. Right.
You know, or even if it wasn't money, just the success of Church Ladies. I had people like, well, what if, you know, Church Ladies, or what if your novel isn't as successful as Church Ladies? I'm like, it may not be, because there are very few books that were as successful as Church Ladies and
right.
awards. And so to me, it's like children, you know, if you have your first child, you know, we always talk about that second child is like, yikes, what the fuck were we thinking? But the first child, you know, makes you think, I can do this again. And then, you know, and it would be like having a second child and being like, your first, you know, your older sibling was amazing in these ways. We now need you to be amazing in these ways. Go, you know, and you would never do that, you know, unless you're an asshole, you know, you would never do that. And so I think of the novel as like a second child, you know, she's going to be who she's going to be in the literary world, which is a different literary world than Church Ladies just 4 years ago. I think we make a mistake when we put so much pressure on the work, whether it's a book or an essay, to be anything other than what it is. You know, that whole thing you were saying, Tommy, about the student who's like, I'm writing this because I've got a score to settle, and this is going to be or the other way around. This is going to be the thing that gets my father to be proud of me. And I tell people all the time, you cannot put that kind of burden on a piece of writing.
Oh.
And so whether it's worrying about, am I going to earn back the advance or is it going to win? This is like, if I worried about those things, I just couldn't write. I don't know how people do it who do worry about those things.
I think this is a really great question, Tommy, because we've been working our whole lives and just got money. Do you know what I mean? That's what I think is so interesting about that question. It's like, it's, and Deesh, I love how patient you were with it, because it's like, it's a big question, because it's not, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, new money. But you don't think about like motherfucker old labor. You know what I'm saying? Like motherfucker, we've been out here working, dog, like working. And now we come up on some money, which to a lot of other people in the world, like a lot of motherfuckers that I work with in academia came into academia, came into grad school with the kind of money we have now. You know what I'm saying? Like they inherited that money. So now, you know, we got it. And it is kind of weird to me. I'm not going to front. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wrote all the shit I wrote up until this point in a kind of like economic fucking precarity. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so a lot of my new work, you're going to see it, like not this kids book I have, a lot of the new work is kind of trying to write from the position now of somebody who like, shit, man, when I see that old, you know, white motherfucker on the street with a, like a hard hat, like 60 years old with a stop sign, you know, standing all day, I think different thoughts about that person than I used to before I had money. I'm not gonna front, you know what I'm saying? So, and I'm just trying to figure out what I do think and what it does mean and what is my obligation now that I do have what people call money, like to my people, to the world, and to people. I don't know, because we just got this shit.
Kissy, I can't let the conversation go without asking about revision. You know, there's words in your work that pop up again and again, you know, meager and gumption, or, but revision's the one that comes up the most. And it feels like to me, it's kind of like become like a life philosophy for you. Can you sort of sum up what revision means to you?
Yeah, I mean, for me today, revision means, you know, like the will to look back at everything that I've made, a relationship, a piece of art, a job, a podcast, and ask myself the hard questions of like, what did I do? How did it bring me joy? How could I be better? Who did I harm? And, you know, I just think like that is a perpetual work that I wish the nation was interested in modeling for its children and its adults, but it's not. So we got to model it for ourselves with the understanding that capitalism is and revision like are antithetical, right? Like the whole point of capitalism is to produce, and get the fuck on. Like you keep on like recollecting about what you're quote unquote creating and asking yourself whether or not it should be created and the ethics of it, you don't get as much shit made. So I'm trying to be a reviser, but you know, I'm very, very aware that like in this culture, again, with like poverty and shit, sometimes it becomes hard to like do what you know is right. But at the same time, I know like looking back at the decisions I made ethically through my eyes and the eyes of people I love is the only way to live any sort of life of any sort of integrity for me. But I know that shit is hard. And I just like, that's just, I want to use my art to do that.
Did you, I want to ask one specific question about Church Ladies. Obviously, you studied Church Ladies a lot for this. You thought about it a lot. You probably heard from a bunch of Church Ladies of all stripes when it was over. Did writing that book and the life it's had since then, has it given you any different kind of relationship with, like, God or religion?
Church ladies and writing church ladies didn't necessarily impact my relationship with God or the church. I think I had kind of made a certain kind of peace there before I wrote Church Ladies. But what it did do was give me a big lesson and a big reminder about how complicated we are as people, particularly as Black people, particularly as Southern Black people, particularly as Southern Black church people, right? Because I never wanted that book to feel like a middle finger to evangelical Black folks. And I'm so thankful that while there are people, evangelicals who don't like the book, there are Black evangelical women and men who love the book, who have taught the book, who have preached the book, you know, which I never could have imagined would happen. It was more than I could have hoped for. I just didn't want people to feel like I was just thumbing my nose. You know, and I think about something, and I don't remember if it was, I'm not going to try and guess who said this, but I was taking a webinar with Rihanna Milcar Scott, and he was talking about satire, and he was quoting someone saying that, you know, if you satirize something, you have to love it, or it's just sneering. And so Church Ladies isn't satire, but I apply that principle there as well, which is if I'm going to critique something, I want to find something, you know, I want to remember, especially if I'm critiquing Black folks, that I love Black people. You know, I love us. You know, we aren't the way we are in churches because we're stupid or because we're backwards or any of the things that people want to say. And so I felt like it was my challenge to write a book that was critical and loving at the same time. Kiese said something about, you know, writing about people in heavy and not wanting people to see themselves, you know, a certain way on the page and trying to find, you know, something about them, not to redeem them, but also, you know, we're not trying to write cartoon characters either. And so that's what writing Church Ladies did for me. And so when I then turned my attention back to my novel, which I started writing in 2007, long before Church Ladies, I felt like I had kind of marching orders because this is a satirical novel. Mm-hmm. And so the experience of writing the women in Church Ladies really kind of keeps me honest in writing this novel.
I want to wrap up by asking a question that I probably should have asked at the beginning, but I want to ask it at the end, sort of the, I guess, superhero origin story kind of question. Do y'all remember, like, maybe the first thing you wrote that sort of lit the spark, either in you or maybe something that teacher or a parent or something really liked that made you feel good? Do you remember something like that that sort of made you think, oh, this is more than just, you know, an assignment?
Oh gosh, I just remembered mine.
You got it?
Yes, and it's not anything profound at all.
Well, of course not.
So when I was in the sixth grade, one thing I don't write now is poetry, but in the sixth grade, we randomly had a school-wide poetry competition that we were required. I don't know why I would have done this. I thought we were required, but that's not true. I don't remember if like everybody wrote a poem and then the teacher picked like three of us from to represent our class. I don't know how it came down to me and these other two students, but the whole class had to sit every day while the three of us stood and rehearsed these poems and just listen to us. You know, somebody was reading Annabel Lee by Edgar Allan Poe. I have memorized that because of the rehearsals. And then somebody else read Charge of the Light Brigade. And I had an original poem called The Lazy Crew, and it was I have never sailed, I nothing, like I don't know where this came from, but it was about this captain who like gets fed up because his crew is lazy and he just like attacks them basically, and it rhymed, which is it was
wow.
And so when we rehearsed, and then the competition happened in the auditorium. My mom dressed me up in red, white, and blue, a white shirt, a red shirt, And the captain takes his sword to the crew, and she made me a sword wrapped in tinfoil. And I acted out this poem, and I won. I won. I beat everybody else in the school. And so even though I don't write poetry to this day, that was the first time I was like, I'm pretty good with words. Like, this is cool. I can't. And I was, so I beat out Edgar Allan Poe. And
I love it. Arthur the Light Brigade. That's so good. That's so good.
Not an essay, but you know.
You know, for me, I'm writing about this in this new book. So I don't want to talk about it too much, but I was in fourth grade. It was an all black Catholic school called Holy Family. And they had one white girl was in the school, Lori Bacutis. Other than that, it was all black, but the sister, you know, the principal was this white woman named Sister Liana. We were fourth grade, Jackson, Mississippi, you know, shit, recess, we trying to run and cuss. And, you know, we just learning to cuss, and man, we was cussing so much. And after recess, Sister Liana came in the room, and we knew when she came in, like, shit was finna get real. And she was like, sit down. And then we were like, oh, shit. And she's like, I just want to say, we will not hear the word fuck, dick, ass, shit. And yo, we looking at this white motherfucker in this room, we like... Like, and if you talk to anyone in that room to this day, they would talk about that shit as being like one of the most profound things that they ever experienced, dog. Like, I'm worrying about why, but for me, I was just like, yo, language is wild. I didn't have that language to say that, but like, language transfixed us, because here this woman was using these words that we heard like our parents use in private. We bringing them to fucking school at recess, and then she bringing them into the classroom, in the front of a classroom where we would never thought we would ever hear those cuss words, you know, our cuss words. Like, we thought they were ours, and here she is, and we were like quiet the whole day after that shit. Anyway, there's something about that story that like really inspired me to just really believe, like, you can besmirch an essay and make it glorious at the same time. You can do the same thing to a classroom. And she did it with that, you know.
As I went back and listened to this interview, I realized that I used the word navigate a lot. That's partly because that's how I see artists like Dicha Filia and Kiesie Lehman. They're out steering their ships in deep water, trying to chart a course for where they want to go. Both of them spent years doing the work for little or no money, just doing it because they had something to say and needed to get it out. Whether it's fiction or nonfiction, it boils down to trying to tell the truth and doing it in an artful way. It's a burden and a blessing to find that spark, whether it's from a poetry contest or a cussing nun, and to keep chasing that feeling over and over again. And surely by now, some young people have read Heavy or The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, and they felt that spark within themselves. Candles light candles. That's the way to make sure the flame never dies. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.